Paradise is a word, an idea we pause and consider every now and again. But is it a place you can actually visit? We're going to talk now to a noted travel writer and author who found that some of the most spiritual places in the world are often violent places. Pico Iyer, who among his projects, he's been the biographer for the Dalai Lama, has a new book. It's called The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. And he joins us now. Pico Iyer, welcome. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be here.
So, In Search of Paradise, yours was a physical search that took you to places like Iran, Kashmir, Sri Lanka, Jerusalem. Why did you set off with the idea of paradise in mind in the first place?
Well, it was a book that really came out of the pandemic. So actually, it was almost a metaphysical more than a physical search. I was staying in my mother's house. She had just emerged from hospital. And like the whole world, I was stuck at home. And so I thought back on my 48 years of travels. What had they really amounted to? And how can we find a better world and a better life, given that we're always confronted with so much difficulty? And you know, as a fellow traveler, that very quickly, every place when you step into a travel agency is presented as paradise or Shangri-La. And I've been lucky enough to go to Bali and Tahiti, the Seychelles, Tibet, and many of them are enchanting. But when I get there, I think, well, it may be paradise for me for 2 weeks, but it probably isn't for the locals. And if it really were paradise, what would it have to gain for me? I would probably be the serpent in the garden bringing corruption. And so it really made me think paradise has to be a way of seeing things. And the only paradise I could trust would be one right in the middle of real life and in the face of death, which is why, as you say, I sought out places of conflict and even war zones.
Yeah, it is, of course, a physical journey, a metaphorical one. And it begins in your book, In Iran. And you write, I was having to rethink almost everything. And boy, did that resonate. I find that all the time in the places I've been. I just have to take my assumptions and understand how many of them have been turned upside down, including my ancestral home of China, the places I think I know I'm perhaps wrong the most. What did rethinking mean in Iran?
Well, I had been writing about Iran from a distance for 30 years. So just as you were saying about China, I felt, oh, I've been studying this place forever and I'm well prepared for it. And within 4 hours of arriving there, I saw I didn't know a thing. And within 16 hours, I had learned more than from 4 years of research. And when I called this book The Half-Known Life, that was partly because sometimes I feel that in this age of information, we know less about the rest of the world than ever before. And often we know least of all about the countries we hear most about, such as Iran or North Korea or Cuba or Yemen. So I really try to see them in the round just to remind myself how little I know about them.
Well, your Iran adventure has a great moment where you find your way in. Perhaps you're sneaking your way into the holiest place in the city of Mashhad. How'd you get in?
I slipped away from my official guide and I found a young, very friendly guy, about late 20s maybe, who offered to take me there. So it was jam-packed because it was the birthday of the long-dead saint. Everywhere people were sitting, sharing sweetmeats, releasing doves into the blue-black sky. And finally we came, as you said, to the innermost sanctum. And it was a tiny space. We quickly got separated. And I looked across the room and I saw that my driver's hand was on his heart and he was walking backwards. So he would never present his back to the saint who had been dead for almost 1200 years. And there were tears welling in his eyes. So he just looked like the picture of Islamic piety. But when we were back out on the street, he told me that his wife was a blonde Yorkshire woman who was waiting for him back in England. And then he told me that he had paid a human trafficker $2,500 to slip him into England in the back of a truck, breathing through a tube so he wouldn't be detected. And then he told me that the British government had very generously given him a court-appointed translator and a solicitor, and they had worked for 3 years to win him asylum status. In other words, he'd risked his life to steal out of Iran. And now he was risking his life every summer to come back to visit the hometown and the mosque. And just as you were saying a minute ago, when he dropped me off at my hotel, I thought, Iran has been in our headlines every day for the last many seasons. but I'd never heard about a dissident returning to the place he'd fled from. And I couldn't remember reading about a very faithful Islamic soul who nonetheless didn't want to live in this Islamic Republic. So just a reminder that the world is always so much more complicated than our ideas or our theories about it.
Mm. Kashmir is, of course, a very complicated place. And it's a place, you write, that your family has a deep love for. When you went to Kashmir as part of these recent travels for the book, did the place bear any resemblance to what you expected?
Yes, the parts I saw were often idyllic. And just as you say, my mother had been there in 1941 and had filled my childhood and adulthood with stories of this bewitching lake under the snow caps with meadows of fresh flowers. And so I found myself on a houseboat in Srinagar. And it couldn't have been calmer. There was a lotus pond outside my window. You could hear nothing but the whir of kingfisher's wings. People would paddle past selling exotic spices. And I thought, this is as beautiful as anything could be. But I could only think that by screening out the fact that 10 minutes away on the other side of the lake was this violently contested, occupied place with 500,000 soldiers that for 70 years has been fought over by India and Pakistan. And so it struck me that I could only call that place paradise by refusing to look at the other sides of Kashmir, which was really real life for everybody else.
Yeah. Well, and you have to kind of hold these two ideas together. These are places that might be considered paradise or are described that way, but also are places of violence. In other places you go to Jerusalem, where we, of course, know of the generations of conflicts there. And you also go to Sri Lanka. It turns out to be a time of peace when you're there, but there have been decades of fighting between the Tamil separatists and the Sinhalese government. What drew you to Sri Lanka?
You know this phenomenon. I was sent there by an editor at a time of relative peace, and yet one could feel the war everywhere. And I think what's fascinating about Sri Lanka is precisely the fact that it's been seen as a paradise by outsiders is the cause of its tragedy. The British, the Portuguese, the Dutch, all of us tourists, everyone wants a piece of paradise, which means that it really is a very fallen and often conflicted place. And just as you were saying about Jerusalem, there's no question it's one of the most stirring, magnetic places I've ever been. I'm not a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, but there are places in Jerusalem that just move me to tears. But of course, the heart of its history is that one person's paradise is never going to be another person's. And it's really a place where all these many paradises converge and conflict.
Why did Jerusalem move you to tears?
Because I think there's an undeniable quality of charisma. Places have charisma, as people do. And after 2,000 or more years of prayer and devotion and people literally walking across the world to get there, there's some accumulated power to that place.
Mm. Boy, Pico Iyer, as I hear you talk about that, I just think about the one time I was able to visit Xinjiang in far western China, which, as you know, the majority of people there are Uyghur Muslims. And it just struck me as some of the most pious persons I'd met, and in some of the most pious places. Many of them are now destroyed, but we kind of remember those moments and remember those people and the feelings that we experience when we go to those places. I mean, you have thought about this, you have written about this, and you title your book, The Half-Known Life. Where does that come from?
It comes from Herman Melville, who, of course, was one of the great explorers into the question of where is God and does the devil exist and what does this all mean? And for me, the half-known life just arises from the fact that the older I become, the more I see it's everything we don't understand that shapes our lives. When we fall in love, when a virus arrives, when a forest fire burns down our house, as happened to me, when suddenly we meet somebody who becomes the love of our life. All of that is outside the realm of explanation. And it's almost as if we barricade ourselves behind the things that we know, but it's really that vast darkness that we don't know that is defining things. And I should say, I've always wanted to go to Xinjiang. The closest I've been is Tibet, and it perfectly speaks to what you were describing in Xinjiang. The more that culture is embattled, the stronger the spirit.
What do you take away from your reflections as you, either as you were on this journey or as you were trying to write it up?
Well, I concluded my book in Varanasi, almost the Asian Jerusalem, another place of great power. And what strikes me is that people go there to burn bodies and commit their bodies to the holy river Ganges. So it's a city of death, but it's also a city of joy. And I think at the time of the pandemic, when death was breathing down our necks and around the corner, I was so glad to remember this place where death is not the end of things, and where in the midst of the dead bodies floating down the river, people are in a permanent state of thanksgiving. And how to put those two together, that the fact that life is difficult doesn't mean we have to be despairing. In fact, it means we have to make the most of every moment and find our joy in the midst of our limited time.
Pico Iyer's new book is The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. Pico Iyer, great pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
So nice to talk to you, Scott. Thank you.